Greetings, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's a preview of what's coming up next on your trusted radio station. Up first, take a moment for thoughtful reflection with Hadith of the Day. Next, we turn to Islamic laws with Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of the prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Following that, join us for Africa Today. For those seeking to deepen their connection with the Holy Quran, don't miss Let's Recite the Quran. Coming up next, it's the Hadith of the Day. Stay tuned.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, salam and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today we explore a striking insight from Imam Hassan al-Askari, peace be upon him, one that applies not just to scholars in turbans or universities, but to anyone with influence or knowledge. A dialogue is narrated where it was asked from the Imam alayhi salam, who are the best of God's creation after the Imams of guidance? And the Imam answered, the righteous scholars. They are the best of God's creation. Then another question, and who are the worst? After Iblis, Pharaoh, and Nimrud, these tyrants in history and mentioned in Quran, and those falsely claiming your names. And the Imam answered, the corrupt scholars, those who promote falsehood and conceal the truth. So let's unpack this powerful message through the lenses of spirituality, psychology, and modern society. Scholars, educators, preachers, experts, they shape how people see truth. When they are sincere, they are like lighthouses in a store. Those watchtowers, you remember? But when they are corrupt, hiding truth, chasing fame, and distorting values, they don't just fail, they destroy. The Prophet ﷺ said, one corrupt scholar can harm 1,000 times more than an ignorant person. Today, many of us turn to influencers, YouTubers, TED talkers, and modern ulama, like so-called ulama, the scholars, in digital form. Their impact can uplift a generation or poison it slowly. So we should be very careful who we choose, who we identify as a righteous, trustworthy scholar, a truthful one, a reliable one. In psychology, there is a concept called the authority-based bias. It shows that people are more likely to believe and obey those seen as experts, even when what they say is clearly wrong. A famous example, the Milgram experiment, where participants gave what they thought were lethal electric shocks to others simply because an authority figure in a lab coat told them to. Now imagine that lab coat being worn by a corrupt scholar. That's the danger that Imam Askari warns us about, where knowledge is used not to liberate minds, but to manipulate and blind them. And unfortunately, the world is getting worse. And we can say that they have played a huge bad part in our history. So beware of the corrupt scholars and get close and identify the good ones. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We have been discussing some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei for quite a while now, and would like to continue along the same line. And let me ask you this question. Is it wrong, Sheikh Javid, to read the Quran and supplications during the menstrual period? I'm talking about the women reading the Quran, of course.
Yes. Well, during menstruation, a woman is prohibited from reciting the 4 verses of the Quran which contain obligatory sajda. Okay, the 4 verses. I'm not telling the 4 chapters, the 4 surahs. Okay,
yes.
Because the scholars are actually divided in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Some scholars say no, it's not permissible for menstruating women to recite the whole chapter or surah of the Quran. But scholars like His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and also His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sistani believe that only the 4 verses which contain the sajda must not be recited by a woman who gets her period. Okay?
Yes.
So what are those 4 verses? The verses, I would like to mention that because there are many verses in the Quran for which sajda is mustahab, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the sajda wajib or the 4 verses include Surah Sajda, which is chapter 32, verse 15, and Surah Fussilat, which is chapter 41, the verse is 37, and then Surah An-Najm, which is chapter 53, the verse is 62, and finally we have Surah Al-Alaq, chapter 96, and the verse number is 19. Okay, these are the 4 verses for which sajda becomes upon recitation, of course, and even upon hearing. Okay, the sajda becomes obligatory, and so a menstruating woman cannot knowingly and purposely recite these verses. So apart from these verses, she may recite other verses of the Quran, she may recite as many verses as she wishes, but also the scholars and His Eminence has said that it is makruh to recite more than 7 verses of the Holy Quran. Makruh means that there is less sawab. It doesn't mean that it is kind of abominable, dislike,
or reprehensible.
The woman should discontinue reciting more than 7. Of course, there is reward, there is sawab for reciting the Quran, but the sawab she gains is less than the usual sawab that is given to the reciter of the Holy Quran. And then when it comes to dua, supplications, and ziyarat, of course, it's quite permissible for a menstruating woman to engage in any kind of supplication during menstruation. She is allowed to do not only supplications, but also other mustahab du'as and recitations, okay? Some people, you know, especially in the Indian subcontinent, are under the assumption and under the impression that when a woman gets her period, it is forbidden for her to touch anything, to wash, to do the cooking, to go to Majales, or to Husainiya and other places. Of course, this is a misunderstanding of the religious losing, a misconception. And it's necessary for them to actually improve their understanding of religious teachings and the Islamic laws. Okay, as for a menstruating woman, she is allowed to do any kind of activities within the house and also to go out to attend majalis, husainiyas, and not to sit in the mosque. Okay, if there is a mosque, she wants to go, she cannot sit there, she cannot halt there, she cannot leave anything in the mosque, she cannot pick anything from the mosque. And if she happens to enter, she should enter from one door and quickly get out from another door.
Yes.
That's what the scholars have said unanimously.
Yes. What about this, Sheikh Javid, quite related to this, of course, as a continuation of this question. Can menstruating women, in fact, touch the Quran itself, like... especially with the name, script, with the title, with the like the word God, Allah,
right.
You know?
No, it is not permissible.
Uh-huh.
She must be very careful not to touch the scripts of the Quran, whether it's the name of Allah, whether it's the verses, and it is absolutely forbidden for a woman to touch the names of Allah, okay?
Uh-huh.
Whether it's part of the Quran or whether it is written on newspapers. Or in any books.
What about cell phone? Because some people happen to read or recite the Quran from their cell phone. There are some apps,
yes,
right? So is it, again, forbidden, absolutely forbidden to touch the script there on the screen?
But the scholars say no, because there is a screen preventing direct touch.
Uh-huh,
it's
I see.
Not forbidden.
It's not the text of the Quran,
the text,
like in writing.
That he touches, that she touches, okay?
I see, okay.
She rolls up and down. So there's no problem.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go anywhere.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/EM. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, a duty-bound asked us, I was in charge of the ghusl janaba, and after performing the ghusl and prayer, I noticed a small amount of glue or a spot left somewhere, you know, on, for example, his hand, from the dressing the night before. Is it necessary to perform the ghusl and the prayer again after noticing such a spot, such a stain?
Of course, it is necessary. In this situation, both the ghusl and the prayer must be repeated, yes? Because the glue formed a barrier preventing water from reaching the skin. So the glue must be removed, and then the individual must wash that area. If it is on the right side or on the left side, mm-hmm. depending. If it's on the right side, then she must wash the left side as well. If it is on the face, on the face of that individual, or on the forehead, then she must do the ghusl all over again, because the head and the because in a sequential ghusl, the individual, the duty bound person, must wash the head and neck, and then the right side of the body, and yes. then the left side.
All right.
Of course, if it is on the left side of the body, like on the left hand arm,
this is the last part.
Yeah, this is the last part. So she can wash the man or the individual, of course, the ghusl janaba. Okay, we are talking about ghusl janaba. So the individual, the duty bound person, can wash that part of the body
after
removing the glue. And then, and that should be the intention of completing the ghusl, because it's not necessary to perform ghusl in a quick succession.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one after another, the head and the neck, and then the body quickly after the you see after washing the head. No, there is no such thing as succession, quick
yes.
succession. Some people might not have enough water, so they can wash the head and neck first. Then after a while, maybe after 30 minutes, they can wash the right side and then the left side.
Yes.
And the ghusl becomes complete. So to put it in a nutshell, I would say that if the glue was on the left side, after removing the glue, it is sufficient to wash only the affected part with the intention of ghusl, and the ghusl becomes valid.
Isn't it related? I mean, talking about the stain. Or that amount of glue left on the body.
Dirt, maybe.
Yes, or dirt, or whatever. Isn't it related to its size?
No, it doesn't make any difference whether the size is...
Is it small or big?
Small or big.
Even at the size of the tip of a needle?
Yeah, needle, yes. If it's that much...
Then they have to repeat the ghusl, right?
You repeat the ghusl, as I mentioned.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mama Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javid, what is the ruling on crying during prayer? We have seen it in some people while they are offering the prayer, they are also weeping,
right,
or crying.
Right.
So is there anything wrong about this? Is it permissible to cry while saying the prayer? Yes.
Yes. Well, the ruling depends on the cause and form of crying. Cause
yes.
and form, the intention of crying. Maybe, yeah, I should say that you use the term cause.
Yes.
You know, if a person intentionally cries aloud for worldly matters, for example, remembering a deceased loved one.
Yes.
Like, or maybe someone cries for the debts she owes other people, or for the wrongs he have committed, for the poor situation that he is in. So this is quite worldly matter, and this invalidates the prayer. And if a person cries silently without voice for worldly matters, the prayer is not invalidated, though it may be discouraged, okay?
Yes.
Because there is no sound produced, no sound generated. And the person cries in his heart about something which is quite worldly, the prayer is not affected, but it is discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Why should one cry for something which is worldly, which is material, right? So it's not haram, but it is discouraged. And then if a person cries, whether silently or with voice, out of fear of Allah, out of longing for Him, his heart regarding the hereafter, or maybe someone when engaging in supplications, for example, he recites dua, and then in that situation he becomes emotional because of fear of Allah, because of extreme taqwa, of course. Then not only is it permissible, but it may also bring greater humility, greater reward, and spiritual depth to the prayer.
Yes.
There is no problem whatsoever when it comes to crying for out of fear for Allah,
mm-hmm.
out because of piety, because of God's consciousness,
mm-hmm.
for something which he failed to do for God's sake, like
mm-hmm.
the prayers he missed, the fasting that he, and the felonies he committed in his life, and he regrets all those mistakes and errors that he committed, so he bursts into some kind of tears. That's not haram, it's permissible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير troubled story, tales full of sadness and woe, but I believe you smile again. You see, I know the pain you're feeling, 'cause I was there just like you before, and I know where it's leading. Hold on,
there's nothing standing in your way. You can be strong.
So show the world what you can do.
You'll be outcast. Sometimes it's better to be alone than to be with the bad crowd. Preserve your mind and feed it. Nourish what it is you have inside.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
In a dramatic shift, the Trump administration has slashed crucial HIV/AIDS funding for Africa, risking millions of lives. Now, as billions of dollars in U.S. military assistance flow to the genocidal Israeli regime, why is Africa's health being sacrificed? Will the continent fight back and build its own future, or is it too late? Now, to help us unpack the move by Trump to cut HIV/AIDS funding for Africa, we are joined by two distinguished guests. First, we have Tahrir Hassan. Now, he is an executive member of the International Solidarity Movement for Africa and Palestine. We are also joined by Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze. He is an esteemed academician and chairman of the Global Pro-Life Alliance. Stay with us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we delve deep into this issue. In a shocking shift of priorities, the Trump administration has drastically slashed U.S. foreign aid, cutting HIV funding for Africa. U.S. AIDS 2024 budget for sub-Saharan Africa dropped significantly, affecting 25 million people in 2024. South Africa faces a loss of $427 million, putting over 500,000 lives at risk. Yet, despite these devastating cuts, the U.S. continues to funnel billions of dollars in military aid to the Israeli regime amid its ongoing genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Since October 7, 2023, the U.S. has spent more than $22 billion supporting the Israeli regime's war crimes. Now, what's more, Trump's rush to exploit Africa's rich deposits of rare earth minerals shows his administration's eagerness to extract the continent's resources while turning a blind eye to the health and well-being of its people. So how can the Trump administration justify such drastic reductions to health programs while prioritizing support for genocide in Gaza and resource extraction in Africa? Is this a clear message that African lives don't matter as much as geopolitical and economic gain? With Africa's future hanging in the balance, will the continent rise to build self-sustaining health systems?
Trump cuts Africa aid, funds Gaza genocide.
The abrupt halt of the U.S. presence emergency plan for aid relief funding to South Africa threatens the country's fight against HIV, putting thousands of healthcare workers' jobs at risk and also disrupting treatment for millions of patients. However, South Africa's health minister says the move by President Trump is a much-needed wake-up call. Let's take a listen.
I want to regard this moment as a wake-up call, because whether we like it or not, it is the responsibility of every government to provide for its people. It's not the responsibility of other governments. I understand the issue of solidarity, but every government on this planet has got a responsibility to provide for its people. That's where it must start, which means there must be very clear political will. Because I agree with Mama Winnie here, that this type of relationship where we depend on one country, and when the country is in some negative mood, the whole world collapses. Yes, it's scary. In fact, I was asking myself, how did we arrive here, where all of us depends on one country?
The U.S. has slashed funding for combating HIV/AIDS epidemic in Africa, including significant cuts to South Africa's initiatives. While it is true Africans might have benefited from the funding, but there are always hidden benefits for the donors. Now, our first question goes to Fahriye Hassan. Now, in your opinion, what was the real reason behind U.S. funding the fight against HIV/AIDS in South Africa and other African countries?
Now, I have studied this quite intensely, and it turns out that much of this funding was designed in order to provide, I would say, it was mainly a United States foreign policy to give funding, but to impose certain directives on South Africa. You know, so while it did alleviate some of the epidemic and treatment on for people, the United States used to use this funding as leverage. I'll give you an example of this. So the Ministry of Health in South Africa would receive funding, but in order for them to receive the funding to treat the patients, they would have to provide the United States with, for instance, coal. They would have to provide them with certain raw materials. So it wasn't a, as I would say, a straightforward, giving money to South Africa as a aid in terms of aid. It was with strings attached.
Now, for a long time, Africa relied heavily on U.S. foreign aid for health programs, especially for combating HIV/AIDS. Prince Dr. Philip Jemanze, this is for you. What's your take on the move by the U.S. to cut its assistance for Africa?
Might be distressing to some people, especially those people living with HIV. But on a systemic outlook, when you look at it as an expert, it is actually a welcome development. Because in the first place, foreign governments should not be investing directly into the health sector, because what they do is that they cause a distortion of the health sector. The United States chose HIV, but that's not our priority. If you look at the epidemiology, HIV is far more less than diarrheal diseases. We could have probably chosen to fund diarrheal diseases, where the money can be now put in provision of potable water. This will provide real development. When you put that money in HIV, this will go to the pharmaceutical companies who are still coming from the United States and other countries. So it leaves no developmental impact in Africa.
The U.S. is cutting billions in foreign aid to Africa, especially in health sectors, while continuing to allocate large sums to military support for Israel, despite its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Clearly, black lives don't matter for the U.S. and Israel.
First and foremost, in Africa, what is the role of Israel in Africa? And of course, the second part is, how does this impact on the genocide that Israel is perpetrating in Gaza at the moment? So what has happened is that Israel, as an entity, has imposed, or as a foreign policy in Africa, whereby in conjunction with the Americans are obviously using their African command or AFRICOM in order to drive certain foreign policy directives. On the other hand, Israel has got a much more sinister need for their role in Africa. So what I'm trying to say is the role that Israel plays is a very nefarious role, in that they exploit and even use slave labor from Africa in order to impose their will in order to carry out. And of course, the fact that the Palestinians, the Gazans, are not going into Israel, it has a major impact on their economy, you know. And as a result, this is what they've done. They've recruited slave labor from Africa in order to carry out their genocide in Gaza.
Trump's policies seem to prioritize military alliances over humanitarian aid. Now, the U.S. is giving military assistance to the Israeli apartheid regime and many African countries. while cutting funding for critical health initiatives in Africa. Now, while the U.S. is cutting its health aid to Africa, its military aid is seen as a source of destabilization in the continent. Dr. Jemanze, do you agree with this?
We don't want the remilitarization of Africa. We don't want all the military games being played, AFRICOM and all the other ones coming up in the continent. Because all what they have done is to fuel internal violence in the country and cause mass distortions. You will see Boko Haram exploded, not because there were no Western presence. There is because there were a lot of Western military presence. So instead of violence to reduce, it actually increased.
Well, thanks for that. Let's take a short break before we continue our discussion on the move by the U.S. to cut its HIV/AIDS assistance to African countries. Stay with us.
Trump cuts Africa aid, funds Gaza genocide.
Former President of Kenya Uhuru Kenyatta criticized African leaders who panicked over Trump's decision to halt foreign aid. Speaking at a health conference, Mr. Kenyatta said Africa should think of how to judicially use its available resources rather than relying on foreign assistance.
This is a wake-up call for you to say, okay, what are we going to do to help ourselves? Instead of crying... To Julize, what are we going to do? Aya, ametoa hiyo pesa. Sasa tutafanya namna gani jameni? What are we going to do? Yeah? To support ourselves.
Now, in light of the U.S. aid cuts, some leaders like we have seen Uhuru Kenyatta have argued that Africa should take greater responsibility for funding its own health programs, citing tax evasion and the looting of African resources by the same Western countries that provide the so-called aid to Africa. Now, Mr. Hassan, do you see these as an opportunity for Africa to move away from dependency on foreign aid and develop a more self-sufficient healthcare system?
I would like to bring in somebody by the name of Ibrahim Traore of Burkina Faso. I think what he's doing in his country has demonstrated that, yes, that Africa can indeed stand on its own feet. And why am I using Burkina Faso as an example? Because one of the things that had plagued the African continent and various countries has been terrorism. It has now come to light, given the Department of Government Efficiency run by Elon Musk revelations about the role of U.S. aid in Africa, and that much of that aid has been going to terrorists, you know, funding of Boko Haram, funding of Al-Qaeda, and so on. What Ibrahim Traore has done, he was able to use his power as the president of the country in order to rid the country of much of the terrorists. What then happened was, as they pushed out the French and the terror groupings, they were able to take over much of the mining industry, the gold and uranium and platinum mining industry, and so on. And with the result of that, now that funding is now coming into the fiscus of the government. And Ibrahim Traore has shown, I mean, he's built something like 50 or 60 schools, new schools. He's built many hospitals, road infrastructure. He's built ports, you know, his road infrastructure, his bridges, and so on, etc., giving people access to more. He's upgraded the agriculture and so on. So this is clear evidence that if Africa can rid itself from Western domination and the colonialist past, and of course. Now it's out in the open that it was the West that has been funding these terrorists. Africa would be able to become very prosperous if they are able to use their own resources.
South Africa's government has vowed not to let the U.S.'s withdrawal of $427 million in HIV/AIDS support collapse its programs, which are among the largest in the world. Experts say that other African countries should follow suit in building more sustainable, self-reliant health systems in response to foreign aid reductions.
The actions by the South African government was in the interest of the South of South Africa. And the Nigerian government, after the withdrawal of the aid, took up the responsibility of providing drugs and the necessary things to people living with HIV/AIDS. These are welcome. That's the way it should be from the beginning. So African countries, we want to get the prevailing atmosphere in Africa is we don't need this aid. Don't give us any aid. Come if you, we want fair trade and we will trade with anyone. You can't dictate to us whether we will trade with this country or that country. No, we want fair deal. If it's gold you are interested in, there is a market price. It's a fair market price. Buy it at that. You can't buy it at 80 cents and sell it at 200 euros. And then tell us that you turn around and give us 10 billion in aid. We could have gotten that money ourselves from the minerals, far more, maybe 20 times more. So we don't, this whole attitude that Africa is a continent that has to be helped with aid is just nonsense, and we don't want any of it again.
While Trump met African leaders amid plans to extract critical minerals from the continent, he simultaneously slashed U.S. aid assistance for African health programs. Dr. Jemanze, how do you interpret this contradiction that while Trump is eager to tap into Africa's mineral wealth, he seems indifferent to the lives of Africans, as evidenced by the deep cuts to life-saving aid like HIV support?
Well, once it comes to the actions of President Trump, he, I think, is guided by the best interest of the United States, as far as they see it. And we should be guided by our own best interest. As I have said before, we do not need Western or any other person's aid. What we need is fair trade. If he's negotiating with African presidents and say, okay, we're interested in your minerals, not to come here for extraction, we want to buy it at the international market, fine. We are open for business. We tell you the price. The price is the international price, market price. You pay for it and you take it. So, and that should be our attitude.
Well, there you have it. For Africa to develop and cut aid dependency, it should benefit from its own minerals and should not let countries such as the U.S. continue looting the continent's resources. I'd like to thank our guests today, Mr. Fahri Hassan and Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze, for their incisive analysis. Seventh session of the Kenya-Iran Joint Commission on Cooperation recently took place in Nairobi alongside the Iran-Kenya Business Forum. Iranian Minister of Agriculture Ghulam Ridha Nouri Ghazaljeh, who led the Iranian delegation to Kenya, emphasized that Tehran and Nairobi are aiming for a bilateral trade target of $1 billion. Now, the session concluded with the signing of a joint communique and seven memoranda of understanding covering various sectors. On the sidelines of the event, Kenya's Prime Cabinet Secretary and Cabinet Secretary for Foreign Diaspora Affairs, Dr. Musalia Mudavadi, spoke to reporters and highlighted the strategic role of Iran in global affairs.
We've talked about health, we've talked about other areas of agriculture, business, trade. That is important. And also, we want to say that as Kenya, we recognize and appreciate the pivotal and strategic role of Iran in making sure that there's peace, not just within the Middle East, but globally, because we have seen in the middle of a lot of tension, the government and people of Iran have also exercised a lot of restraint to make sure that conflict does not escalate. And I think that cannot go unrecognized. So we, as we move forward, we want to say that we want the partnership between our two countries to be solid for the benefit of the citizens of both countries. Thank you.
And now let's move on to the next segment of our program, a celebration of Africa's magnificent civilizations, which form the foundation of its rich cultural heritage in today's rapidly changing world. It's more crucial than ever for young Africans to reconnect with their roots. Preserving this identity is essential for building a confident and empowered future. My colleague Janet Ali has more on this.
Hello, I am Janet Ali, and welcome to a new series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Carthage civilization. Founded by the Phoenician settlers from around Tyre, 814 BCE, Carthage was located in present-day Tunisia. The city's strategic location on the Mediterranean coast facilitated trade and naval dominance, making it one of the wealthiest cities in the ancient world by the 4th century BCE. Carthage controlled territories across North Africa, southern Iberia, and several Mediterranean islands. Carthage's rise to power was marked by its maritime capabilities, extensive trade networks, and a formidable navy. The city's economy thrived on trading goods such as gold, silver, ivory, and textile. Carthage also developed a complex political system with a powerful ruling elite and a strong military composed of mercenaries from various regions. However, Carthage's prosperity eventually led to the conflict with the Roman Republic. The two powers clashed in a series of wars known as the Punic Wars between 264 and 146 BCE. Despite the famous exploits of General Hannibal, Carthage ultimately lost to Rome. The Third Punic War between 149 and 146 BCE ended with the complete destruction of the Carthage by the Romans. The city was razed and the territory annexed. The Romans later rebuilt Carthage, making it an important center of the Roman Empire. Today, the ruins of Carthage are a UNESCO World Heritage Site, preserving the remnants of this once great civilization. Notable structures include the Birisa Hill, the Antonine Baths, and the Punic Port, all maintained as part of the Carthage National Archaeological Park. That was a brief description of the Carthage civilization. Thank you, and join us next time in the next episode of Get to Know Africa. From me, Janet Ali, it's goodbye for now.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
Muscle of life. The sound of living. sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. Let's recite the Quran.
وإذا قرأت القرآن جعلنا بينك وبين الذين لا يؤمنون بالآخرة حجابا مستورا.
القرآن نور وبيان. القرآن هدي الإيمان. القرآن مسك الختام.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners listening to IRIB English Radio right now. Welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem. Inshallah, today we will practice verse number 23 and verse number 24, Surah Al-Ra'd, on page 252. So, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, hope you have the Quran with you. Please turn to page 252, Surah Al-Ra'd. Verse number 23 and 24.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم جنات عدن يدخلونها ومن صلح من آبائهم وأزواجهم وذرياتهم والملائكة يدخلون عليهم من كل باب.
Gardens of perpetual residence, they will enter them with whoever were righteous among their fathers, their spouses, and their descendants. And the angels will enter upon them from every gate, saying,
سلام عليكم بما صبرتم فنعم عقب الدار.
Peace be upon you for what you have patiently endured, and excellent is the final home.
Nice recitation, mashallah. Allah bless the reciter, inshallah. So, guys, let's first take a look at what Allah Almighty says in this ayah, and then, inshallah, we'll practice the tajweed points and the recitation. Verse number 23. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Wait. You remember we talked about those who have patience for the sake of their Lord's pleasure, yes? They maintain their prayer وأقاموا الصلاة in the previous ayah. And they spend out in the way of Allah what Allah Almighty has provided them with. And also they repel evil conduct with good. Allah Almighty said that أُولَٰئِكَ لَهُمْ عُقْبَ الدَّارِ, right? They have the reward of the ultimate, at the best place, which is Jannah, yes? Now here Allah Almighty explains عُقْبَ الدَّارِ, which one? What is that? Allah says جَنَّاتُ عَدْنٍ, okay? جَنَّاتُ عَدْنٍ, that دَار, that place is what? جَنَّاتُ عَدْنٍ, the gardens of عَدْنٍ. يدخلونها, it means the best place of Jannah. يدخلونها, which they will enter that gardens. ومن صلح من آبائهم, not only them, and along with them, whoever is righteous from among their four fathers, okay? وأزواجهم وذرياتهم, and their spouses and their descendants. Not only you, for example, look, if you are a good person, of course, if you are a good person, it means you are from a good family. Yes or no? And yes. If you are a good person, you can bring up good kids. Yes or no? So, if you go to heaven, if you deserve that to go to heaven, inshallah, that you will go, Jannat Adn. If you go to Jannat Adn, then from your descendants, the righteous people from your forefathers, they will us will enter with you, your spouses, and the good people from your children. They were all descendants. They all will enter. وَالْمَلَائِكَةُ يَدْخُلُونَ عَلَيْهِمْ مِنْ كُلِّ بَابٍ And the angels will call on them from every door and comes welcome them. How do the angels welcome you? سَلَامٌ عَلَيْكُمْ بِمَا صَبَرْتُمْ سَلَامٌ عَلَيْكُمْ بِمَا صَبَرْتُمْ Peace be upon you for your patience. فَنِعْمَ عُقْبَ الدَّارِ How excellent is the reward of this ultimate abode. So it means how excellent, how beautiful is this place. Enter. ادخلوها بسلام
آمين
سلام عليكم بما صبرتم Wow, nice. Do you want to hear that one day? As soon as possible?
Inshallah.
Inshallah. Allah may grant us with Jannah, with the Imams, with the Ahlul Bayt, with the Prophets, inshallah, and with the righteous people there. Inshallah. So guys, refer to the Tafasir books, inshallah, to learn more about these two verses. Let's go to the Tajweed points. I want Masoom to recite the first ayah once. Then inshallah, Hassan.